Mystery Crate has been presented by ZipRecruiter. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire.
This is a special edition of the Mystery Crate. Typically, what we do here on the Mystery Crate, and I can't really say that. There have been, like, what, four episodes? Yeah. It's whatever we want it to be. And this one is actually syncing with one of the biggest sporting events in the world.
The Super Bowl.
Not the Super Bowl, Chris.
You can't say Super Bowl. I think that's illegal.
I think you can say the Super Bowl in this context.
Call it the Soul.
Oh, you're just talking about what Chris is...
No, like legally. Liam's here. Liam, are we going to get sued for saying Super Bowl?
Just don't put any sponsors with it. You'll be all right.
All right.
And we'll get to why Liam is here. Many of you who listen to the Dan Le Batard Show with Stu Gatz know Liam as our corporate babysitter. And some of you might know Old Money Charlie from when he was a member of the Shipping Container down here based out of Miami. Now he's in D.C. overseeing the simulcast of our show on ESPN Ooze. You're asking yourself right now, why is Liam here? Why is Charlie here? Well, because it's the Champions League final. Again, not the Super Bowl. And Liverpool is playing Tottenham. Liam, our babysitter, supports Liverpool. And Charlie supports Tottenham. So it's a huge game. And we actually have members of our universe that have stakes in this. Okay, they support their teams. And we're going to talk a little soccer. And I'm sorry about that for those of you who don't like soccer. But it's the Mystery Crate. You kind of signed up for whatever the f*** we wanted it to be. So it's going to be soccer for a little bit, and then be patient, or just hit the 30-second forward button a couple of times.
No, don't do that.
Okay,
you listen to this.
You listen to this, and then you'll get something else. A couple of things coming your way. Those are also a mystery. For the love of God, get off our asses. With that being said, Chris Cody, this whole network, Le Batard and Friends, it's brought to you by a special sponsor. Who is that sponsor?
That's Tissot. Do I have to talk like this?
No, go for it. Just say it normal.
Guys, Tissot is the official watch of the NBA. Each one of Tissot's timepieces delivers quality performance and traditional luxury. This graduation season, get the NBA fan in your life a Tissot watch. The Tissot Chrono XL is a great watch for those looking for a sporty chronograph with Swiss technology at an unbeatable price. Shop now at us.tissotshop.com. That is us.tissotshop.com.
You're in the zone. That's the best you've ever done it. No flubs. No flubs.
I think I said performance weird, but whatever.
It's okay. It's Champions League week. Yeah. All right.
A game that Everton will never be in.
Never, ever.
Who am I supposed to root for? Let me just jump in and steal the show here. Who am I supposed to root for in this game? Because Liverpool and Everton, big enemies.
You're rooting for Tottenham because you're an Everton supporter.
Yeah, but
you can't have anything good happen.
But I'm not from Liverpool, so I just kind of feel, hey, they're from Liverpool. Everton's Liverpool. Let's, Liam, am I wrong here?
Yes.
Yeah. I'm not from Liverpool either, and if Everton was in it, I wouldn't want them to win.
Oh, come on.
All right, I'm a Tottenham guy.
You probably want to edit out that entire portion of the podcast for your Everton supporting friends. That's not a great look for you.
Yeah. Smug Old Money Charlie is a Tottenham supporter, and I, as Dan called me, U.S. Chelsea Mario Lopez, am obviously a Chelsea supporter, and I don't want anything good happening with Tottenham because they are a longtime rival of Chelsea. Liverpool also, no real good results here. I'm just picking the lesser of two evils. I want London to remain blue and for Chelsea to remain the only London team with a European Cup.
Billy, who's your club?
Well, that's what I was going to ask, is like the point of this at the end for like us to pick a club or team or whatever. Is this for a real trophy or a fake trophy?
This is the biggest trophy in European club soccer.
Somebody cover Mike's ears because he just won a Mickey Mouse trophy. This is a real trophy.
All right. Wow.
Someone cover Charlie's ears. He doesn't know shit about trophies.
Wow. So like the biggest in terms of prestige or size?
Both.
Everything.
Wow.
Yeah, it's nicknamed Big Ears. The handles you hold it on are so big, it looks like Prince Charles's big ears. You have to hold it up by that. So it's the big one.
We're going to lay out of your way because we want the Tottenham supporter and the Liverpool supporter to go at it, explain this game, maybe break it down a little bit. But I think your goal here is to not lose Billy's attention. Wow, have we done it yet?
No, man. I'm already looking at this trophy. It does look like it has big ears.
With that being said, we are off. Take it away.
Yeah, thank you so much for that introduction. There are so many things there that probably made you consider turning this podcast off and discussed. If you did, I guess you're already gone. I'm not sure why I'm talking to you right now. If you didn't, thank you for sticking around. I promise this is going to be less insufferable than you might think. So let's begin with a bit of an explanation as to why the two of us are talking to you. As was mentioned, we are fans of these separate sides. So Liam, let's start us off. Tell us how you began supporting Liverpool.
Well, you know, when I was a kid in England, anyone that doesn't know, I was born in England, lived there till I was 12, then I moved to the States. But when I was a kid, Liverpool were the team. They were the best team. So, I mean, if you want to call me a front runner when I was 4 years old, you can. But, you know, Ian Rush, Kenny Dalglish, Bruce Grobbelaar, John Barnes. When you're a kid in England, you got four TV channels and the newspaper comes on Sundays and they're only going to show the best team. All I saw was Liverpool. That's why I've supported them, and I've supported them ever since I was a kid. So coming up 40 years.
Yeah, I think, you know, you're English. You were 4 years old. I think you're off the hook for being a front runner. Also, my story is considerably less authentic, as you can imagine, growing up in the States. I think when I was in high school, and I want to say this is like probably mid to late 2000s, so I forget like the exact FIFA video game year it was, but I used to play with Tottenham on career mode, and like of all the players on those teams, you know, Berbatov, Robbie Keane, Ledley King, I had like a real fixation on Jermaine Genus, of all people. I'm not sure why. I didn't really watch the Spurs matches at that point because they weren't shown a ton here, but when NBCSN got the contract in 2013, I was like, I know this team. Jermaine Genus is my dude. Let's go with Tottenham. And I've been pretty obsessed ever since.
That's the funny part about it. A lot of the people over here that aren't United fans pick their teams from FIFA.
It's an interesting sort of phenomenon. And I kind of love it. It's like, I think some people are afraid of like, oh, we have our own sporting tradition over here for the Premier League that isn't authentic. But I think in a way, it's like sort of an American authenticity. So I'm embracing it. I'm all in. Jermaine Genus, you are absolutely not listening, but if you are, I love you, and I was a big fan of the digital version of you in the mid-2000s.
That's brilliant. And actually, going back to what Mike said, I was at the Arsenal. My wife is an Arsenal fan. We were at the Arsenal pub in New Haven, Connecticut yesterday. Shout out to those guys. And all the Chelsea fans want Liverpool to win. All the Arsenal fans want Liverpool to win. So we have that going for us.
Yeah, you know, coming off an English final, another all-English final. So yeah, to kind of move off our fandom, this is why we're here. But for those of you who are listening who maybe you're not fans of the game, might be neutrals in terms of the teams you support, probably worth talking about why this is going to be a great watch, regardless of your sporting or rooting interest. So just speaking from a Tottenham point of view, I think all you have to do is go and watch the highlights of the second leg of the quarterfinal against Manchester City. Go and watch the highlights of the second leg of the semifinal against Ajax. Spurs never make it easy, but they always manage to make it interesting. And I think the thing that both these teams do that you don't always see at the stage of the competition is they really like play a positive style, and they try to take the game to their opponent rather than, you know, you see a lot of teams at this stage setting up defensively, looking to minimize their mistakes, looking to kind of capitalize on their opponent's mistakes. And these teams, they don't do that. They really kind of take the game to each other. And so I think it'll be, you know, high intensity, high energy for those reasons. Do you think that's fair, Liam?
100%. Yeah, I agree. I think everyone says that we're favorites on paper just because of, you know, we finished second so far ahead of you guys on points. But for me, it's going to be a Premier League match that has a trophy at the end of it. And I really think it's going to be 50-50 once that whistle goes. So, but I mean, like you said, all the way through the group stages for you and all the way through the group stages for us, we had unbelievable runs. Liverpool, if you don't know, lost the first leg 3-0 to Barcelona and had to win at home 4-0. And we did it without our two best players. And I know for you guys against Ajax, you needed 3 goals in the second half, and your best player was on the bench too. So both managers are great. As you said, both teams play excellent style of football. And I think it's going to be really entertaining. And I think we're just going to pip it, Charlie. I don't know about you.
This is too friendly. Like, why are you guys saying how great the other team is? Isn't this like the Super Bowl of soccer? Like, you're playing for the Prince William Ear Trophy. Like, shouldn't you guys be angry at each other? Like, what's happening right now?
Well, you got to let us get into the keys of the game, Billy. Mm. Like, just let us kind of set it up, do all the pageantry, get the pleasantries out of the way, and then we'll really kind of start going each other's necks.
Are these teams good? Are you guys good teams? Because I was told, a little birdie told me, both teams are not so good.
Who told you that, Mike?
Who are your birdies? Yeah.
Well, I mean, you know,
expose your birdies.
Names.
Don't expose your birdies.
I just dropped it in his ear that you guys are perennial losers and disappointments and famous for what is called a bottle job.
All right. We have five of these trophies and we're going for our sixth. So, we have that going for us.
Charlie, how many do you have?
The last one being in what, 2007, the miracle in
2005 in Istanbul.
Okay. So it was further along and you guys have never won a Premier League, right? I just want to go ahead and.
Yeah. So, I mean, I think Mike would hate to admit this, but Liverpool have a very rich tradition. Liverpool and Manchester United are probably the two most, you know, storied teams in the history of the Premier League.
If you're like 50.
Yeah, Chelsea's a Johnny come lately, right? I mean,
well,
let's be real.
Chelsea.
Fake fans.
For people that have come like
we
lately.
We ain't got no history.
That's right. Like, so Chelsea's obviously, Chelsea's Russian oil money, and then City is like the newer version of that, Middle Eastern oil money. So Liverpool do have a storied history, but like, you know, it's been a while since they've won something significant, and this year they really had a great chance of winning the league and came up short, whereas Tottenham are kind of like your lovable underdog, so to speak, and I think the cool thing about this team is that they've really built, they've gone out and bought players, but a lot of these guys are from the academy, and, you know, Pochettino's done a great job of building up a team that, you know, kind of started from scratch and grew up together, and so to make it to this final, they really did not have a great regular season, and they did a lot in terms of getting lucky in this competition to arrive here, but they're in the title game. So,
how many,
you know,
trophies?
What more can you ask for?
How many trophies?
I mean, they last won the Premier League, I want to say in 61, and I think I want to say they won like a European trophy in the 80s, like 84, I believe was their last European trophy.
Go ahead, ask me when my last trophy was.
I heard you got a Mickey
yesterday.
Mouse trophy yesterday.
Yesterday was my last
real
trophy.
One.
17 since that Russian oligarch, that wonderful man, took over Chelsea Football Club. Not as many for the other clubs.
I'm leaning Charlie right now just because his team hasn't won it longer.
Yeah, aren't Chelsea fans nice? This is great, right? Like,
not at all. Chelsea fans are the worst.
I'm really leaning into it.
We had six Chelsea fans there yesterday, and they were all like Mike. It was brutal.
They were all charming
and handsome.
Let's move it on to the game itself. And Liam, with apologies to your rich and nuanced footballing heritage, we're going to do this American style. Three keys to the game. So, Liam, let's begin with your first for Liverpool.
We need to control the middle of the park. If Henderson and Wijnaldum have a really good game, I think we take it.
Yeah, I think so. And it's funny because I think that point segues nicely into what my first key is, which is going to be the health of a Harry. And it is not Kane. For the uninitiated, Harry Winks is a central midfielder, came through Tottenham's academy. He's been pretty pivotal when healthy this season, especially when playing alongside Moussa Sissoko. This is where I'd like to go on my Moussa Sissoko and N'Golo Kante hot take. Mike, again, might want to cover his ears here.
Don't you dare.
Wait, is this key number two or is still key number one?
This is still key number
this
one.
Is
this
an
is
aside.
Like,
okay.
This is key 1A. This is like a small tangent coming off of key one. So I really wanted to look at statistics and say these guys are the same player. They're very much not the same player. And Kante does a lot of different things that make him one of the best central midfielders, box-to-box midfielders in the world. But Sissoko has really come into his own this season. He's got an incredibly high successful dribble rate, and he does do a lot in terms of being physical in the middle of the park and breaking up play. And so just as it's important, you know, with the note you made, Liam, about, you know, Wijnaldum and Fabinho and whoever they end up starting in the center of the park for Liverpool to control the game there, I think if Sissoko and Winks can start, they've been such a great combination this season. And I think that Sissoko, the one thing that he isn't great at is being a technical player, and that's what Winks really kind of nicely complements him in terms of like his vision and his passing range.
Yeah.
So I think if those two guys can start and play well together, then maybe it kind of takes some of the pressure off that you know you're going to get with Liverpool's sort of high press that the Jurgen Klopp loves to play.
Wordy key.
Yeah, are there any shorter keys?
My keys are pretty long. I'm looking at my keys now, and I think I need to shrink some of these keys. But you know what? Let's go ahead and move to Liam's second key.
It's the defense. For anyone that doesn't know, we were in the Champions League final last year, second year in a row, and we lost 3-1 to Real Madrid because one of their players injured our best player. But we won't talk about that.
And you weren't as good.
And it's true, we weren't as good. Then we went out and we got a new goalie and our central defender is there. So the back five this year is better than our back five last year, and I think that's what's going to help us. That's key number two, back five needs to play really well as well.
That's some good key.
I promise Liam and I did not share notes before because my second key is also the way Pochettino sets up the defense. I think you can look at, I think if you look at, I mean, obviously Tottenham and Liverpool are familiar with each other, but if you look at the Ajax, you know, second leg or the both legs really, and the way they set up the back line, I think there are a lot of similarities between, you know, what Ajax did in terms of having David Neres and Dusan Tadic and Hakim Ziyech. Like, basically Liverpool's an upgraded version of that with Sadio Mane, Roberto Firmino, and Mo Salah. Really, like, Tottenham in that first leg especially, I think playing a back three, they got lost in terms of who am I supposed to be marking. You know, Tadic and Firmino, I think there are a lot of similarities there in the way they move and kind of drop in rather than playing like a traditional forward. So for me, I think it's, you got to set up in a back four. I know that you're in a disadvantage on the wings with Danny Rose and Kieran Trippier trying to take on Salah and Mane, but I mean, Vertonghen and Alderweireld, one of the best center back pairings in the world. If they set up in a back four and they just kind of stick to that formula that helped them in the second leg of City and Ajax, I think that's going to be important.
What is an Ajax, just for those who don't know?
Isn't that house cleaner?
It's a house cleaner, and isn't it's also it? Yeah. A storied Dutch football team. So a little bit of both.
That was a good key. You're giving so much information and I'm trying to keep up, but it's like really, really hard. But I'm assuming that people that know what you're talking about, like, really like this.
If you've listened this far, which God bless you if you have, I'm assuming you know what I'm talking about. So now I'll toss to Liam's third key.
That's a third key, halftime adjustments.
Hmm.
Whichever manager gets it right with the halftime adjustments, I think we'll end up taking it. I mean, I think this year we beat you 2-1 both times. But in that second match, man, at Anfield, we got lucky. Halftime, whatever Poch did worked at halftime. You're all over us. And then at the end, you know, Lloris dropped it and we won 2-1. But I think whichever manager gets in there at halftime and makes the adjustments from what they see in the first half and the team takes that to the pitch, that's what's going to win it.
We are so in sync, Liam.
Wow, no way.
My third key is how Harry Kane is used specifically. I think Harry Kane should start on the bench and come on sometime after halftime. I think that, like, in the past, when Kane's been healthy, even if he's coming right off injury, Pochettino's been tempted to and has started him and played him the full 90. I think that would be a mistake. I think that if you – Llorente was such a huge impact sub in the second half of that Ajax game. Mm-hmm. Basically, Kane's like a super, super version of that in terms of being able to hold up the ball and, you know, have guys like Lucas and Son play off him. I think if they start him on the bench and bring him on for like a nice, like, you know, energy boost, maybe like 60th, 70th minute, that could really be the key for Tottenham.
Yeah, I was talking to one of my mates who's Irish. He's a Spurs fan too. And he was saying, no, if he's fit, you got to start him. And I was like, man, I think you go with what got you there. And then when you need him, 20 minutes, have him go nuts for 20 minutes. If you need a goal, if you want to just hang on and you can do the break with Song. So I actually agree with you there too.
I'm on Liam's side now. Just his words. He said mate.
Liam sounds so much better.
He really does.
I feel like a fraud.
You've said a lot of words, but Liam's chosen his words so wisely that they've been really effective.
If I had like even just a trace of a good accent, I'd try it out, but I'm just lost here. Liam's clearly coming
out
ahead.
Well, let's hear it. Fake it.
And then I'll fake an American for you.
Switching
roles.
Okay, here we go. Let's do our best here. All right, so Hey, Liam, mate, any final words, scoreline predictions, mate?
I got to do my America.
Okay. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
God, I'm all of a sudden blanking on how to do an American accent. Usually I sound Texas.
Texas.
I sound Australian, though.
Australian in general.
Anyway, right?
I feel like I sound Australian, too, so this is really weird. We got to a really
Come
weird
on,
place
dude.
Now.
Dude, you know... Charlie, mate, now I'm still sounding Australian, a bit more Australian than I was before. Let me see if I can build up to the Australian and then go into the American.
Let's just do this. Let's just both do Australian for the rest of the podcast.
Yes.
All right, mate. All right. G'day, mate. Put another shrimp on the barbie. Look, if Klopp's team goes walkabout, we ain't going to win that match, right? We got to get the Wallabies out there. You got to get the Kangaroos and the Koalas. And I think I don't do scoreline predictions, mate, but Liverpool going to win this one. Don't you worry about it.
Right, mate. I have to disagree respectfully, whatever, however you say that in the outback, mate. 3-0 Tottenham. Goals for Lucas, Sonny, and Harry Kane. We're going to smash them, mate.
It was so bizarre because he actually started sounding English when he tried to sound Australian.
It's bad.
And then
it's
he sounded Australian when he was trying to sound English. All right, Billy, you heard.
I just want to hear Liam's Texas accent now.
Yeah, do a Texas accent.
I can't do a Texas accent, man. I'm not from Texas.
Wow. That's pretty good.
If I was from Texas, awesome. I've been hanging out with that guy, Will Kane, all the time. He's been teaching me lots of Texas stuff, baby. And I'm telling you, Charlie, don't you worry about it. Liverpool got this match in the bag. Long live Klopp.
Yeah!
Wow!
Wow, we're going for Liverpool, aren't we? Yeah. Oh, another trophy-less season for Tottenham. Put it in my veins!
I'm so utterly defeated. Well done, Liam. Well done.
Cheers, lads.
That was fun. I really enjoyed that. Are you invested now? Do you have a side for the Champions League final, Billy?
When is this game?
It is Saturday.
At what time? Is it like a 6 in the morning thing? Or?
No, this is not 6 in the morning. I think it's a 3 p.m. start. It's very convenient.
Yeah. After listening to that, Billy, do you know what a leg is when referring to soccer?
Everybody has two of them.
There you go.
Champions League kickoff. Champions League kickoff time is indeed 3 p.m.
I guess I shouldn't say everyone has two. That's insensitive to people that don't have two legs. I'm sorry.
It is an all-English affair, as you know, Liverpool and Tottenham. The game is being held at the Bernabeu in Madrid, Spain, so that's cool. Winner takes on Chelsea in the UEFA Super Cup. So we get... It's not a fake cup. It's a very exciting. We get to do this all over again. We got a very exciting segment for you. You heard the fake Will Kane there, and Liam. That was a wonderful accent that he did. What an unbelievable thing! I was not expecting that. Anyways, we're going to get into an interview that we did with Will Kane about his past. Ooh. All right, we're not asking him about the Cowboys. We're asking Will Kane about his career. But before we do that, some words from our fine sponsor, ZipRecruiter.
Finding a new job is a lot of work. What if you had your own personal recruiter to help you find a better job? Now ZipRecruiter's technology can do that for you. Just download the ZipRecruiter job search app, let it know what kind of jobs you're interested in, and its technology starts doing the work. The ZipRecruiter app finds jobs you'll like and puts your profile in front of employers who may be looking for someone like you. If an employer likes your profile, ZipRecruiter lets you know. So if you're interested in the job, you can apply. No wonder ZipRecruiter is the number one rated job search app.
You are so right on all counts, Roy. And right now, our listeners, we encourage you to go out and download the free ZipRecruiter job search app today and let the power of technology work for you. Don't wait. The sooner you download the free ZipRecruiter job search app, the sooner it can help you find a better job.
That's right. ZipRecruiter, the smarter way to hire.
The smartest way. Yeah. So, I mean, okay. Either way, we were close enough. Yeah. Pound it. Here's a look at Will Kane that you didn't expect. Fellas, did you know that Will Kane planned quinces?
I think you need to explain what quinces are for a lot of people that don't know what that is.
I'm glad you mentioned that, Billy. Quinces are essentially Sweet 16 parties for Hispanic families. Instead of Sweet 16, they celebrate with the 15th birthday, and they're blown way out.
How old were you when you were planning these, Will?
I was in my 30s. I don't know. It was a... When you say I was... planning quinces, it kind of paints a picture as though I'm a party planner and I'm helping you with your wedding.
I love this picture that we're painting. I love it.
Yes. But that's not quite the way it was. I helped plan them, I would like to think, on a more mass market scale. I did. I had a magazine, an event company, and a website that was a little bit like the wedding magazine industry. There was a company back then called The Knot that was helping people get married and walk their way through the process. And it was a great internet startup company. I thought, you know what looks a lot like a wedding? A quinceañera. It's a lot of the same advertisers, a lot of the same business, and those young ladies and their families who, as you said, blow it out. They need some guidance too. So I created this business to cater to that market.
Did you call it El Nudo? It's not in Spanish.
It was called Quince Girl, the magazine. It was in English and Spanish, primarily English, because the data says that most young people, even of Latino background, speak English primarily. And it was a magazine that you bought. And then, of course, you would see advertisements for dresses, and then you'd see, like, maybe a budget in there, and people wrote articles about, you know, what you should do for your musical act or whatever, for your damas and caballeros. It was very real.
So you just saw that there was a market for this. Like, you didn't have some interest in quinceañeras, but you were just like, this seems to be an untapped market.
It's a hustler.
Absolutely. I mean, if I did have an interest in quinceañeras, that would be more disturbing.
How many editions, I guess, were there of Quince Girl?
The magazine came out twice a year, and the business lasted about 3 years.
I imagine you like riding into town on a cart and you're like, hey, everybody, here's Quince Girl magazine. And then as soon as you get like the checks or whatever, you then ride out of town and you're laughing your way to the bank.
I was a behind the scenes player. No, man, listen, I had started several businesses and they were in the media mostly. I had started a business, newspaper business back in Texas. I was involved in like suburban weekly small town newspapers. It was a good business. I sold out of that. It was a good entrepreneurial lick. And I always wanted to do something in the Hispanic market. It was a booming demographic, and I wanted to find something that truly applied to what we, or the government, calls Hispanic. It doesn't mean anything, right? That encompasses everybody from backgrounds from Mexico to Chile to Brazil to the Caribbean, and it totally masks over what their cultural differences are. So what is truly a unifying characteristic? What is something that everybody gets in on? And the quinceañera is the only thing I could find that no matter where you come from, except for Puerto Rico, the quinceañera is part of your traditional past.
So as the editor of Quince Girl magazine, what was the most ridiculous thing you had there? Because growing up Hispanic, I went to quinces, and there were the people that had the Cinderella carriages, and there was the ones that wanted to be Little Mermaid themed, so they came around in a spinning shell, and they had like the mermaid fin or whatever it's called. So how much of these items did you have available, or articles written on these articles did you have in Quince Girl magazine?
A ton, man. But I didn't write them. I wasn't the editor. Yeah, I was the publisher. I was the business guy. I'll tell you, what do I remember, like, the specifics from that? You know what was big? Because this is, the years are probably like 2006, 7, in that range, 8. Reggaeton was big.
Oh, and, oh go on, Wilkin.
Daddy Yankee was ruling shit.
Do you remember RBD? Arbede?
Rebelde.
They were the hit. I mean, they were everything. They were hot. I have no idea where they are today. You wrote an article on them. You get an interview. You talked about reggaeton, which is, they weren't reggaeton, by the way. But, and you know, if you can get them as your musical act, bravo.
So you, wait a minute. Hold on a second. You were having people book RBD for quinceañeras?
Again, I didn't book any of this stuff. I had a magazine that would say, hey, this is what's hot. You could talk about this. This is what it would cost. Here's some ideas for helping you plan. I mean, I didn't ever once help anybody specifically who would call and go, hey, can you help me get RBD for my quinceañera?
Do you still get phone calls to people looking for help to plan their quinceañera?
No, and I never did. That's the point I'm trying to make.
So if you were to plan, based on your experiences planning quinceañeras, Will Cain, what would you describe as the perfect quinceañera? Walk us through. Let's say you have a daughter. She's going to be 15, and you're going to throw her a big quinceañera based on all your experience planning quinceañeras. What would you do?
Well, let's talk turkey, Billy. What's your budget?
So let's say conservatively, Sweet 16 style from the MTV show, our budget is $100,000.
Wow. Nice.
What are we doing here?
Well, how many caballeros and damas are you going to have?
Oh, man. You know what? Let's go big. Let's do 15 damas and 15 caballeros.
Nice. Okay. We're going to get to that 100 grand quick. So.
Well, that's the thing. I feel like now we need to up the budget a little bit because no. This is going to be a big affair with 15 on each side. And I want to have all my family there. And, you know, I want to show off and have their parents be there, too. And all the kids in my school. We're going to have roughly 250 guests for this quinceañera. So now our budget's going to have to go up to what? Like 200 grand?
I don't know. Yeah, you're going to have, what, we're looking at like $50 a plate here. That's a lot of math for a podcast that I can't do.
Ooh, $50 a plate is conservative. Is that what quinceañera plates go for? Wedding plates are expensive. I know that.
What's a wedding plate cost?
A wedding plate, if you're looking at a wedding plate now, it's in the 120 range, and that's like on the low end.
You probably got to do a paella, something cost effective where you can serve a lot of people.
Money's no object in the Will Cain quinceañeras here.
I mean, money, it all goes to the food and the venue. So, you know, what are we going to do here? Where are we going to do it? What are you going to feed everybody?
What was the hot spot back in the
let's
day?
Let's talk venue.
Again, I'm not the editor.
So you did branded quinceañera girl events.
That's right.
Where you had to blow out quinceañeras. You did plan parties to an extent.
No. So that's an expo. You ever heard of like a bridal expo?
Yeah.
Yeah, it's a quinceañera expo.
All right, so what's in a quinceañera expo? The same stuff?
All your local vendors come in. The quinceañera shops in Miami come in. They get a booth. They bring their dresses. And then my job is to bring in all of the young ladies and their families from the area. You know, so I have to advertise on radio stations and local magazines and newspapers. So an expo is like a car show or a boat show, you know?
Did you ever scout quinceañeras? Did you ever go and just take a notepad and say, oh, this is what's hot now?
No. But again, I wasn't the editor.
No wonder this failed.
I don't know how this could have failed because there's still quinceañeras now. Like, it seems like if it's something that you were interested in doing, like, this could have gone on forever.
Were you pushed out by a larger publisher?
Oh, yeah. Is there like a quinceañera cartel?
No. It failed because it was too tight of a niche. I mean, I made plenty of my own entrepreneurial mistakes in doing this business. The minute that 2008 came and you had a larger mass market recession, when you have a tight niche, you have no room for any kind of decrease in gross revenues or sales or anything like that. You know, I had to let it go. You can keep pouring money into it and you ask yourself, what's the upside? How much money have I put into this? What's the potential exit strategy? How much is this thing going to be worth if it realizes all of its potential and math stops making sense? And so at that point in my life, I'd had like a success on my resume and a failure. And I realized the only difference is, you know, whether or not I made money or not. And that sounds like obvious, but when you don't make money, there's nothing to cushion your self-evaluation of how I spent the last 3 years of my life. The answer for how I spent the last 3 years of my life was helping what we're all joking about. 15-year-old girls planning their quinceañera. It wasn't really my passion. Whatever I did next, I said, I don't want to be passionate about it. And it turned out getting yelled at by Stephen A. Smith was that exact right thing.
That was a move for you? Like, how'd you pick yourself up after Quince Girl failed?
Yeah, man, it actually was a huge moment. Because the newspaper thing was a success. I made money on that. And then I failed on this, and I was living in New York City, and I truly did come to this conclusion I'm talking about with you guys. Like, I just want to be passionate. Whatever it is I do next, I'll figure out how to make money. I think I understand business. I think I understand entrepreneurship. I'll figure it out. I'll hustle it. But I just want to make sure that no matter what the outcome, success or failure, I'm happy with how I spent my days. For me, from when I was a kid, I argued with my dad at the dinner table. He was a lawyer. We all debated. I went to law school. I loved law school, and I wanted to be involved in conversation. To this day, I love a real conversation. I hate bullshit conversations where all we do is sit there and tell each other how right we are on everything and stroke each other's egos with falsehoods. It's nonsense, and it's 80% of human communication. And I don't care if that makes me coarse or abrasive or less likable. You're all just lying to each other most of the time. So I like real. And I wanted to do real. And I thought most of what I see on TV is absolute crap and fake. And when it's fake, everybody thinks it's real. and the opposite is true as well. Everybody thinks what's real is fake. And so I just thought I could do it better. And I wanted to do that. And politics was the place that I thought I would do it first, because that's where you're having real conversations, I thought.
All right. So do you put Quince Girl on your resume when you apply for a job at ESPN? ESPN finds you.
Absolutely.
Do you say, my background here is Quince Girl is one of the things I'm most proud of?
I don't remember because I don't really do a resume at ESPN, but I would. I would absolutely. I'd put it front and center. I would put any failure front and center. I think it's hugely important to, like, you know, how much you've risked, whether or not you're going to be successful, kind of who you are. Have you ever failed? Yeah. I hope the answer is yes.
All right, so I'm thinking the Biltmore, 250 people, we have 15 damas, 15 caballeros.
What if you did it right there where you are? What's the name of that hotel where you are?
The Clevelander?
Yeah.
This is not, no. Please.
No?
You think the Clevelander is where you throw a quince at Will Cain? Ridiculous.
In 2007, what was the must-have that every quince girl had to have at her party?
Who was the big-time actor at that time? Oh, who was the guy just in Narcos?
I mean, there's several seasons.
No, no, no.
The Chilean actor?
Mexico.
The dude that was in the Star Wars movie?
Yeah, he is.
And I'm what is Pedro?
He plays Miguel Felix Gallardo. And he was young. And was he in Motorcycle Diaries?
Diego Luna?
Diego Luna, yes. He was in E Tu Mama Tambien, right?
He was.
All right, it's Mystery Crate Concept, and as you know, this is going to be a little bit more self-indulgent. We're going to talk about some of the things that we're into, and I'm fascinated with the world of stand-up comedy, and Greg Giraldo was a mythical figure in that world. He was beloved by his fellow comedians, and he passed away in 2010 of an overdose of prescription medication, and he's just got an incredibly fascinating story. If you remember some of the older Comedy Central roasts, Greg Giraldo would always steal the show. So I'm bringing on Matt Ballacher, who co-wrote, along with Wayne Jones, Greg Giraldo, A Comedian Story, to share a little bit about this book and to provide some insight into Greg Giraldo's world. Thank you so much for taking the time out to join us, Matt.
Thanks for having me. I really appreciate it.
Can you talk a little bit about the motivation to write this book? A lot of people who follow stand-up comedy closely were fascinated with Greg Giraldo, or were you as fascinated as a lot of those people were?
Probably that fascinated and then some. I mean, I think anyone who spends several years writing a book about someone has to have a pretty high degree, maybe unhealthy level of fascination. But yeah, absolutely.
Did you know Greg Giraldo at all, or was this just purely fandom?
I met him, but I didn't know him. I purchased one of his CDs in Southern California and shook his hand. But I know I was a big fan really ever since the early 2000s from his sets on Conan and then on Tough Crowd.
How many people actually really knew Greg Giraldo, the person? He seemed to have some really close friends in stand-up comedy, but there was an air of mystery about him. Am I wrong in that assessment?
No. In fact, that's a really good point. In fact, not many that knew all of him, and that's kind of the fun part of researching a book and then writing it. Like, for instance, we talked to one of his high school girlfriends, and then later we talked to some of his college roommates, and then law school roommates, and then a woman he was married to for almost 10 years. And so each person gives a little different look into his life. But it's a good point. Very few people, I'd say, knew all of him. You know, maybe the book will help tell his fuller story.
Greg certainly had his vices, and we'll get into that in a second. But for some stand-up comedians, their inspiration comes from a rather dark place. Was there anything in Greg Giraldo's past that might have formed his comedic stylings?
That's another interesting point, because he had, for all intents and purposes, a wonderful upbringing. You know, two-parent home, very supportive, incredibly loving, great brother and sister. But he suffered internally, and he had what therapists call the imposter syndrome, and that's this belief that you're never good enough, even if your work is fantastic. And I think that might have driven him, and it also led to angst, which I think fed some of his comedy. But he mentioned that he felt he was funniest when he was optimistic and happy, but he definitely had a dark side.
How did he become optimistic and happy? Is that where he started turning to some of his vices?
I think his vices helped numb him from the mind chatter that was telling him he wasn't good enough or he wasn't a quote-unquote success. But, I mean, he had a lot of really great things. I mean, he loved his three boys incredibly, and he had a wonderful wife and support system. And I think those people helped give him an optimistic side that propelled his comedy.
He had a certain respect that not many stand-up comedians have. Like, he was a comedian's comedian, right?
Of course. I mean, he was right up there in terms of, like, a Lenny Bruce or a George Carlin or Chris Rock or someone who comedians really admire.
I know you went into great detail researching this book. I see the foreword was written by Colin Quinn, who Greg collaborated often with. How many active or past stand-up comedians did you speak to? What are some of the great stories that you heard from some of these comedians?
Sure. Well, we spoke to, I think, about 63 people. Many of, I'd say, I'd estimate maybe 45 of those were comedians. But one thing that stands out was from an interview we did with Jim Gaffigan. And when they started out together kind of doing the open mic scene in New York. And back then, Gaffigan really wanted to be like David Tell, kind of a brash, you know, New York comic. And Greg Giraldo really wanted to be like Brian Regan. And Brian Regan is a hugely successful, but very clean, observational comedian. And not the type of comic that Greg became. But it was just funny because Jim Gaffigan is known for being this clean comedian now. But when it started out, it was very different than how it ended up.
Considering the circumstances surrounding Greg's passing, was there any sort of pushback from family or close friends about you writing this book? Or was everybody just generally cooperative when wanting to share his story since enough time has maybe passed?
So that's an important point, because I had not written a book before. And so many people, especially family and friends who weren't necessarily public figures, were a little reticent. You know, there's some pushback as to, like, you know, why are you doing this? What is your angle? But then once they realized I was coming from a place of celebration of Greg, I think there was a therapeutic aspect where they opened up more. And I think that really helped create this more complete picture of him, because it wasn't like he was a saint. And I don't think it comes off that way. But, you know, I think it was important to be able to share some of his warts so you can appreciate his overall humanity and his struggles.
Even to this day, there still seems to be a lot of mystery surrounding the circumstances around his passing. It's not the easiest thing to pin down. What can you tell us about some of the things that you uncovered, maybe the general mood surrounding Greg around that time? What spotlight do you shed on that terrible time?
We have first account interviews of people that were with him the day he died or the night before. And it was kind of a whirlwind of emotions. On one hand, he was living on his own, and that created problems because, you know, he was no longer with his children, but he was with a girlfriend who was sober and apparently a very good influence in terms of not opening up those, you know, prior vices of drugs and alcohol. But his last show, he met up with some people and partied and did drugs, and that caused a fight. You know, his girlfriend was very upset that this happened. And so they reconciled. But, I mean, it kind of goes to show that when you're used to this pattern of being sober and then falling off the wagon, it only takes one time, unfortunately, to end it all. And he probably drank and did as many drugs as he had in prior weekends. And unfortunately, that was the weekend that he didn't come back.
It's really hard to sort of explain mental health. Seemingly on the surface, Greg Giraldo had a lot of things going for him, and he had the respect and admiration of his colleagues. He wasn't this huge megastar, but the comedy game sort of works funny in that people can break late. So it's kind of weird that someone who was so respected, who constantly had that positive reinforcement that he was indeed funny because he was making some of the funniest people in the world laugh and crack up hysterically, he still felt like he didn't belong.
Yeah, I think that shows how difficult it is to understand and treat mental illness. And I'm not in any way, shape, or form an expert, but I learned more about it. And what goes on between someone's ears is really hard for other people to understand. And it's one of those things that, you know, we have to talk about it more. We have to be more willing to be open about our own issues with mental illness. But it's a very multifaceted and difficult thing to treat.
Considering the respect he had from fellow comedians, I imagine some people have reached out to you from that world. What sort of feedback are you getting from some of Greg Giraldo's colleagues?
Well, Colin Quinn was incredibly gracious to write the foreword, and that was one of the first reviews I got, and that was sort of a relief because he really liked the book, and that was validating to me. Recently, Brian Regan has said good things about it. Jim Gaffigan, Judy Gold, who's one of Greg's friends, has given it a positive review, along with Nick Swardson. And it just came out, so hopefully there'll be others. But getting the positive feedback from the comedy community has been incredibly rewarding. And I think this book will go a long way to help preserve Greg's legacy.
The book is Greg Giraldo, A Comedian Story. It was written by our guest, Matt Ballacher, along with Wayne Jones. You can get it now wherever books are sold online, Amazon. Is there any other information that we should give the people in selling them this book and telling this story, Matt?
They can go to our website, greggiraldobook.com, or check us out on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram. The handle is @GregGiraldoBook. So we'll have special events, book signings, deals. So that's the best way to get more information on the book.
All right, go ahead and check it out, because he was a fascinating talent and a real tragic story, and hopefully some lessons can be gleaned from it. Thank you so much, Matt Ballacher, for taking the time to join us.